Meeting of the Human Services Committee. Senator Bates.
Thank you. Please come to order. Senator Bates, just stand at ease for a moment. Okay, we're going to open a brief public hearing on Senate Bill 443. Rick, would you say a few words about it?
Thank you, Chair, and I'll go right to the Dash 2 amendments. In your staff measure summary, you have a description of the Dash 1 amendments, but just a few minutes ago, we did get a copy of the Dash 2 amendments, which basically does change the whole intent of the bill. It's a basic gut and stuff bill. It does define what a health clinic means in this, and it's basically to allow volunteers, doctors, and surgeons to serve in primary care, physical health, and dental organizations. On the second page of the amendments, it does give under what type of licensing auspices surgeons and doctors have to qualify for, and also allows the Board of Medical Examiners to set the fee for these volunteer doctors by statute or by under their own authority. And there was some discussion about perhaps changing part of the amendment.
Okay. Bill Markham, would you please come up and sit in the middle? And Dr. Bates? Senator Bates and Senator Westland, please come forward. And Bill will sit in the middle, and we will discuss what needs to be done to move this bill, because there are a few technical difficulties that we have that we can solve and move it later. So let's talk about Dr. Bates. Senator Bates.
Thank you. For the record, Senator Alan Bates from District 3, Ashland in Medford. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for listening to us today. This is Senate Bill 443. In my previous life and experience with this committee, I'm often on the wrong bill, so I assume I'm on the right bill this time at 443, correct?
434.
Don't start.
Westland.
This bill and the companion bill we'll be talking about, I assume in a few moments, 605, is a very straightforward thing, although it's been difficult to get exactly the right language for us. We have a situation in the state of Oregon now where we have a significant number of physicians coming to the state to retire. And many of those physicians, after they've been retired for a short time, find out that, gosh, it'd be nice to do some more work. They'd like to continue doing what they've been doing all their lives, which is taking care of patients. However, there were several things blocking them from doing that. One was that they were not able to set up an office and take care of the medical malpractice issues involved, and they wanted to do volunteer work for indigent patients who couldn't afford health care in any other way. 605 will discuss that. This particular bill, however, takes care of a licensing problem for them. Many of those physicians who come to the state are not licensed in Oregon because they've practiced their entire careers in other states. When they came here, they would find it was somewhat difficult at times to obtain that license. It's expensive, time-consuming, and at times a very difficult, complex examination which new medical graduates take what might be necessary for them to take. This bill allows them to have an active Oregon license under certain limitations inside a voluntary clinic where they are being supervised by a physician, as long as they have not been out of practice for more than 2 years, and they are in good standing in their own state from which they've come from. What it really means for Oregonians is that we have physicians who have good experience, are capable physicians, who can come to the state and go to work in free clinics for indigent patients. They will not receive any pay for that. They'll be doing this pro bono. We're trying to make it something they can do and afford to do without taking risks to themselves, but giving good service to the people of Oregon. That is, in essence, what 443 does. There are two problems with the bill. One is that there is no such thing on line 6, page 2 of the 443-2 as a Federation of State Medical Boards. I wish there was. There is an examination, a federal examination, though, which we'll give you the proper language for before the bill is moved. And paragraph 6 in that same page is unneeded, and it needs to be deleted. Other than that, the bill stands as amended in 443-2. Thank you.
Senator Westland, did you have anything to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is indeed my pleasure to be here today
And as most of you already know, I usually don't get too excited about one specific bill or the other, but today I can assure you that this is the exception that makes the rule. Colleagues, Senate Bill 443 and its companion piece, Senate Bill 605, are not just important bills. They are keystones in our efforts to provide access, keyword access, to quality health care to some of Oregon's most frail and vulnerable human beings. Just as importantly, they are the beginnings of a culture shift as to how we provide health care to those some odd 600,000 Oregonians that currently fall into the gap between the Oregon Health Plan and commercial insurance. Traditionally, our only solutions to this gap population was, in simplest terms, dollars produced by a rising and robust economy. More hires, companies are more profitable, better able to provide health benefits, additional revenues provided into the state general fund by additional tax revenues from individuals and corporations. We would obviously respond to that by expanding OHP eligibility, and companies would be better able to afford benefits for additional employees. We would close the gap by pushing from the bottom and the top. And while that's great, we must remember that even during the greatest economy in the history of the planet, we could not close that gap. So just as obvious, new solutions must be found. I call my approach, Dr. Bates, several of us have worked on this, you, Mr. Vice Chair, I call my approach community-created solutions. Dr. Carver, whom you will hear from in a moment, is involved with VIM, Volunteers in Medicine. And while there probably does exist a small distinction with a difference in their fundamental ideas, the fundamental concept is that of individual communities determining their own specific health care needs, and then matching those needs with local assets, doctors, PAs, dentists, hospitals, empty buildings, vacant lots, all the way down to and include janitorial services provided either gratis or free. It has to be a complete community effort. So identify the local need, you find out what assets are within arm's reach, and you coordinate and collate them into an effective health care providing organization. Which brings us back full circle to where 443 comes in. These clinics need volunteers. And for retired physicians or those that have recently moved to Oregon but still retain a valid license from the prior state, they need an expedited licensing process that provides for adequate background checks, protection for consumers, but still does not discourage or disincent these truly valued individuals from providing truly needed health care for Oregonians that are currently not getting it. I'd be happy to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Senator DeMonta Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it says in the bill other health care providers. Would this take into account nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, nurses?
Well, let's not get, we've got two bills here, and it's my understanding 605 does.
Okay.
And 443 relates specifically to physicians.
Yes, and their liability.
The obvious complication there, Mr. Chair and Senator Morris-Henderson, is that nurse practitioners come under a different board. And they would have to have either be included in this as a different board, and that would entail a whole different discussion with that particular board, too, and how they license and so forth. The problem for physician assistants in the state is that a physician assistant coming in from outside the one to take part in this would then have to, under the complication under our state laws, would basically have to partner up with a physician who's willing to supervise that individual. So I think this is an important first step, but I think the other two issues, while we may be bringing them forward at a later time, is something we really didn't address in this bill, unless I am mistaken, other than, I'm talking about 443 now, other than 605, I believe, does.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay.
Bill. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Markham.
Former Representative Markham. The other bill on the House side, which is up for third reading a week from tomorrow, includes all 19 of the health care practices. So we're going to get this covered some way in the three bills, and I'm getting myself confused on it, but hopefully that helps.
Okay. Thank you very much. Kathleen Haley, would you please come up and... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering if... Yeah. If it's confusing here, don't leave, Senator. Well, I'm just curious here in the dash two, where it says to uninsured patients or patients with incomes less than 200% federal poverty. So. It's a definition of health clinic. How much of a change is this from the definition of health clinic?
What section are you in?
Section 1, dash 2 amendments, line 5 through 10. Says, for the purposes of such section, health clinic means a public health clinic or a health clinic operated by a charitable corporation. And I'm just wondering... If that is narrowing the universe, I mean, we're assuming all health clinics, wherever they were at some point in time, and I didn't know they had those restrictions on them. So I'm just curious about that section, why we aren't just using what's already in statute for the definition of health clinic.
Quite honestly, I can't answer that. Where are you?
The dash two amendments, Senator,
page one,
section one, lines 5 through 10.
Senator Bakes, would you like to sit down again?
No.
Okay.
I understand the definition, or I understand the second page here quite fine. Thank you very much. I just wonder why we're changing in section one.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think your point is well taken. And frankly, these dash twos were just put out at my request as far as the second page was concerned. I assume the first page had stayed the same. We will make appropriate changes before you see this for any work session if you had a chance to research this. I see no reason why the normal definition shouldn't hold. I don't know why that was changed. I'll make sure that's recognized.
Okay. I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, that we aren't excluding clinics by changing the terminology.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, I think you've got a very valid point. When we start making those kind of changes, we could find ourselves in difficulty.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Good, you're going to take care of that.
Well, okay. Although possibly the answer is in 605, this 605 has a much broader definition. This bill would still apply. I mean, I there could be an inconsistency here. I think for purposes of 443, which we will obviously get to the bottom of, I actually think this paragraph works because they're just defining it as defining volunteer.
Well, in all due respect, Senator, for the purposes of this section, which is defining the volunteers and their freedom from liability, you could be limiting the clinics they could serve in.
And you certainly don't want to do that.
Right. That's just the point I'm trying to make there. So,
very wise.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Chair,
that means you can get up and leave.
I'm confused now. Thank you.
That's all I can find at the moment, Senator.
Oh, my goodness.
Kathleen Haley, if you could find room to scoot in and... Okay, you are here to comment. The question was raised about other health care providers. I don't know if that's what you want to address or just in general.
Chair Morris said, first I'd like to make a statement. I'm the chair of the director of the Board of Medical Examiners, and the board supports the idea of allowing physicians who are well qualified to come into the state.
Your name, please.
Kathleen Haley. I'm the executive director of the Board of Medical Examiners. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm here to support the notion that Oregonians be served, particularly in these public health clinics, by retired physicians who are capable of doing so. And the board would support the Dash 2 amendments with the changes that were noted by Senator Westland.
Okay. Now, I guess conceptually you would support the expanding of this bill dealing with practitioners to the House bill that includes all medical practitioners that were mentioned by Representative Markham?
Well, Senator Morissette, this bill is really narrowed to physicians, and I think that other professions should really comment on their boards and associations.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Dr. Carver, would you please come up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Members of the Senate Health Policy Committee. For the record, my name is Ron Carver. I currently am the Medical Director of Volunteers in Medicine Clinic of the Cascades in Bend, Oregon. I am here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 443-Dash Amendments, but at the same time, I want to encourage you to consider making this bill even more meaningful. I certainly appreciate the work that has been put into these amendments and the legislature's willingness to address this issue. With a few exceptions, the steps taken in the Dash 1 amendments are already included in the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners' current administrative rules. The Oregon Board of Medical Examiners' mission is to protect the health, safety, and well-being of Oregon citizens by regulating the practice of medicine in a manner that promotes quality care. Without a doubt, we are all grateful for their continued vigilance over health quality, healthcare quality. However, the legislature has the ability and responsibility to look beyond the BME's mission in improving quality of life. As the number of Oregonians without basic health care continues to escalate, I am hopeful the legislature will look at more innovative ways to increase access to health care services. The current amendments before you today are a step in the right direction that could also be even more innovative by removing the existing barriers for retired out-of-state physicians to obtain volunteer limited license. In the end, this will better address our growing need to increase access to basic health care services. I'd like to take the next few minutes to highlight the need for this policy action, with your permission. In the past 4 years, the percentage of Oregonians lacking health care insurance has increased from about 12% to the current 17.2%. The number of uninsured in my county, Deschutes County, has increased from about 10,000 to the current 14,000. State health ranking of Oregon has fallen from 19th in 2003 to 21st in 2004. And the people under age 65 without health insurance have a 25% greater chance of dying from diabetes, heart disease, HIV, AIDS, cancer, and trauma than those with insurance. As you've heard, the volunteers in medicine model which started in South Carolina in 1992 and has since developed in 40 clinics around the country, including Eugene and Bend, uses primarily volunteer retired physicians and other healthcare professionals to provide basic health care to the uninsured, and this has helped to address the critical issues of access in our communities. This model has been successful in South Carolina because the legislature established a volunteer limited licensure category with no cost and limited paperwork to allow retired out-of-state physicians with active licenses in other states to provide charitable, uncompensated care in nonprofit clinics under supervision. I've attached for you documentation of this, a number of letters from South Carolina. The VIM Clinic of the Cascades was opened actually exactly 1 year ago, in March of 2004 in Bend, to serve the uninsured of our county with volunteer physicians, nurse practitioners, nurses, and other healthcare professionals and volunteers. In our first year, we have seen over 5,000 patient visits, and this has had a significant effect on the quality of life for those uninsured in our county. For this effort, the board chair and myself were recognized as co-citizens of the year by the Bend Chamber of Commerce, and I was recognized as Dr. Citizen of the Year last year by the Oregon Medical Association. The current problem for physicians retiring to Deschutes County as well as other places in Oregon is that the current licensure requirements has resulted in no out-of-state physicians getting the current emeritus licensure. None. Zero that I'm aware of. This is due to cost, due to the threat, the possibility of examination, and the considerable paperwork that's required to obtain this licensure just to do charitable uncompensated care. And I've got attached letters from several physicians regarding their difficulty. And on the reverse side of those emails, what I could get off the web about their current status of licensure, listing a variety of things, that their license is in good standing, et cetera. And I also have a letter from Dr. Hugh Johnston, current medical director of the Eugene VIM Clinic and past chair of the Board of Medical Examiners, with his opinion that this volunteer limited license would really be of great benefit. I've also enclosed the actual legislation from South Carolina that's in this packet, and the particular amendment that I would prefer to see if I had my way, which really requires, these are the requirements: retired from practice or osteopathy no more than 3 years, does not have an active Oregon license, but has maintained good licensure in other jurisdictions for at least 10 years. Practice would only be permitted in nonprofit clinics, such as VIM, where services are given to indigent patients under medical supervision, under supervision of a physician with an active license, who must be on the premises at the time. The licensee must receive no remuneration for these services. And to document for the BME, they have to provide, and I've listed that in this, and I don't know that I need to read that, and I've given the potential rules and regulations that could be provided. What do I think the result of doing this would be? Even with a few retired out-of-state physicians providing services, if they were granted this limited license, it's my judgment and that of Hugh Johnston and others of us in VIM that this would significantly enhance our ability, the ability of our nonprofit clinics to serve the uninsured in Oregon and particularly in our areas. This would increase the number of capable, qualified, motivated retired physicians in Oregon, and there's no evidence from the experience in South Carolina that such licensure would jeopardize quality of care, but rather would increase basic health care to the uninsured. The limited license would actually be more restrictive than the current emeritus license that's available to physicians who retire in Oregon, because it would not allow any practice of medicine outside of a nonprofit clinic and only under direct supervision. I might mention that in Deschutes County, the Volunteers in Medicine Clinic is included in our disaster plan as a place of triage. And Deschutes County recognizes that retired nurses, physicians, and other healthcare professionals could respond in the event of a natural disaster or a terrorist act and be vital in helping to care for people in such a situation. The citizens of Deschutes County have worked for the past 4 years to respond to the increased need of the uninsured. An amendment to Senate Bill 443 to establish a volunteer limited license with reduced cost, minimal paperwork, and no examination for out-of-state physicians with active medical licenses in good standing would help us much better succeed in our efforts. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Monasanger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're focusing on retired I think that's a pool of providers that really we should get back into our system. But is there a problem with volunteer providers that are not retired? And do you have even those who are in nursing school or in med school that just want to volunteer on their own time? Is there different issues regarding that issue?
Well, at BIM, we have certainly a variety of practitioners that are volunteering, nurse practitioners, nurses, physician assistants, and we encourage that. We do have to have licenses for them if they're going to actually take care of patients. We have a number of retired nurses without licenses who actually act as aides, if you will, and can room a patient, do a variety of things. The reality is we need to have either a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, or a doctor who they're the ones licensed to give, to prescribe medications and so forth and do procedures. So we need this pool of people. The real rub comes in physicians. We have a number. I mean, I can think of one doctor who's working right now in Indonesia for Northwest Medical Teams. He doesn't have an Oregon license, but he's got a valid license elsewhere, and he's off in Indonesia serving people, but he can't serve us in Oregon because he doesn't have that licensure.
Okay, what we're going to do is call Kathleen Haley up, and I don't know that we want to put this in the existing bill at this point. If it's going to cause any problems, we amended this bill several times already. You want to reintroduce yourself and comment?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Medical Examiners. And first, I would like to applaud Dr. Carver and the work that he's done, and Ben, and Dr. Johnston and Eugene. They've really done a fabulous job with setting up these clinics and getting people served. The position of the board is that they want to encourage retired physicians, and that's why the fee for the renewal is so nominal. At the same time, the board believes that Oregonians who go to these clinics deserve the same care as other Oregonians and the same kind of scrutiny of the applicants. So that's the position of the board, and we think that this bill in the dash 2 with some of the amendments will achieve that. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
That which bill? The Dr. Carver suggestion, or just the bill that we have with the dash 2 achieves what your goal is?
Chair Morissette, the dash 2 with the amendments achieves what we're going to
do. Now, concerning Dr. Carver's suggestion, you're saying without Dr. Carver's suggestion, with the dash 2s, we are achieving the goal. Is that what you're saying?
That we are achieving the goal.
Okay.
That's right.
Now, which leads me to believe that you're not particularly supportive of including Dr. Carver's amendments into this bill, which I am not, if it is any way causes a problem with the bill.
Chair Morissette, the board has had concerns regarding this relative to reducing the scrutiny that physicians from out of state have coming in, because not everyone who tries to come into the state has the same goal as Dr. Carver.
Okay.
And at the same time, we have tried to encourage physicians by reducing that fee to $50.
Mm-hmm.
And that would do that.
Dr. Carver, did you want to...
My only comment about $50, that's once you already have the license and it's being renewed. So the actual fee for a physician from out of state is more like $300 plus the potential of an examination and the paperwork involved. So the $50 is only once you already have the emeritus license, and then it's time for renewal, if I understand correctly.
Go ahead.
Chair Morissette, that's true. There is an application fee of $350. However, with this bill, with the dash 2s, you'd be cutting out a lot of the need for that examination, because as long as the physician had stopped practice just within 24 months, they wouldn't require that examination. But beyond 2 years, do you want a physician who's out of practice longer than 2 years working on patients? And in consultation with Dr. Bates, as well as our board members, the board members were uncomfortable from a public safety perspective of extending that out.
Yeah, Ms. Chair, I think the dash twos as we will see them in the dash threes are appropriate. One of the problems I see with this suggestion is it does change the definition of where they can serve significantly, and I think that muddies waters. We don't want to muddy.
Senator Morris Anderson.
Yes, I would like to go with the way the bill is, but let's monitor. I tend to agree with Dr. Carver that we're probably there's a pool of physicians that maybe we're missing, but let's see how successful we are with this, and then we can always expand in the future. But I would hate to. Even though I love having the physicians on medical, Northwest medical team in Asia, it sure would be nice to be using them here in Oregon.
Well, I like what you're doing. I like what you're attempting to do. My only concern is at this point we're running out of time to do another set of amendments. We're going to move this bill today, and we're going to have to wait for the other amendments to be fixed up, and to inject a whole new thing is kind of confusing and complicated. But I would like to at some point consider your idea as a standalone and see what, you know, and do that. And I guess I would suggest that during the interim we invite you to come in and talk about how this is going. Well, let's see, when will this take effect? There may not be time during the interim, but we have to monitor this and see how it's working and expand the pool, because I do think we ought to take advantage of the physicians who are available.
Mr. Chair, this takes effect July 1.
Okay. Well, there won't be a whole lot of time to monitor before we have an interim. Of course, we'll probably be here in the middle of August, so we can always...
No!
June 15th.
Come
on. August 15th. Yeah, that's fine.
No, June 23rd.
No. Well, we'll come back, and then we'll go August 15th. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You need to share this information, Senator.
It's there for everyone to see. Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 443, and we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 605. And Barney Spate and Senator Westland is not here.
There he is. He's kind of here.
Where? Oh, there he is. Yes, you're up. And Representative Markham, would you come up again, please? And now, if Barney gets up and leaves, and
we're not going to do the bait and switch this time.
Okay. No.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Barney Spate, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Program, but appearing today on this bill in a kind of pro bono health policy role. I believe the Chair and the Committee have before Senate Bill 605-2 set of amendments. These amendments do two or three fairly straightforward things. One, in the area of the bill that talks about informing physicians and other healthcare providers of the opportunities to volunteer, etc., we insert the terms professional and trade associations. The intent is that the Department of Human Services would work primarily through the professional associations of healthcare providers on a annual or every 6 month basis, using their professional newsletters, websites, etc., to make both practicing healthcare providers and those who have retired aware of the fact that they can practice in volunteer clinics with some immunity from medical malpractice. We have stricken the issue of recruitment to make this bill have no fiscal impact. I have clarified on line 18 of inserting uninsured before the uninsured low-income patients. And then, most importantly, from a policy point of view, is that by adding the term clinic to the persons or entity that is immune from liability, we narrow that the clinic's liability is narrowed only for the professional work provided by the volunteers. And this was an amendment requested by, I believe, the Oregon Trial Bar, and was accepted in a companion bill on the House side to make certain that it is a narrow immunity for the clinic. Those are the explanations of the dash two amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just a little confusion once again. Once again, we get into definitions and health clinic. Why is it necessary to put uninsured in there? Why not just leave it at low income?
What line are you on, Jeff?
That would be line 18.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, the intent is to make certain, and there has been some discussion in other committee hearings about the definition of clinic, the health clinic. It was to make certain that we capture the thought that there are clinics who almost exclusively serve the uninsured, low-income, uninsured, and usually on either a sliding scale or a no-fee basis. There are also clinics who serve an array of patients. Some of them are insured by the Oregon Health Plan, some by Medicare, and some have commercial insurance, while they also serve the uninsured on a low-income sliding scale basis. We tried to craft the definition in 605, which I will admit, in your perception, is different than the definition in 443. Is to make certain that we capture the clinic is serving people that are uninsured, and the way they're charged for the care rendered to uninsured is either on a sliding scale or no scale basis. It's not intended to, and I wanted to make this remark because somebody did mention to me that the term primarily is used in that definition.
Right.
Primarily is intended to modify health, physical health, dental health, and mental health. It's not intended to modify the nature of the clinic. That is, a clinic could have a volunteer working in its program serving just the uninsured low income. It may have paid staff, for example, a rural health clinic or a federal qualified health center, might have paid staff to serve others. So the intent is to narrow the use of the volunteer for the uninsured low income. That's how the definition was crafted. It may be imperfect, but that was the intent behind it.
Paul, yes.
And I appreciate, and I know the intent behind this. I'm clear on that. I'm just, clinics are there to serve a variety of people, and even if you have insurance, if you don't have a primary care physician and you're not part of a plan, a clinic's where you go because that's where you can get coverage. And I've been in that position myself, in between docs. While one retired and it took me a while to get another primary care physician, I went to the clinic, and I have insurance. And I guess I just, once again, it's the definite, it's not who we're attempting to serve here. It's making sure that the definition of clinic isn't going to exclude facilities in who will be served in this context. So,
Mr.
And you're telling me we're okay with this? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer absolutely okay. We're okay. I think there is, there's some lack of clarity. I think that by the attempt in the dash twos to add uninsured, was to actually add clarity. From what I hear your remarks, you think it actually may make it less clear of what the purpose of the definition is.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I want to follow up on what Senator Cruz was saying, because I have actually volunteered in a couple of volunteer clinics, actually in the state of Virginia, but be that as it may, I can't imagine a clinic where we didn't have some low-income state-sponsored people coming in, mixed in, and even Medicare patients coming in just because of access. It's closer, it's more convenient, and so I see that that would be a problem unless you made sure that your retired volunteer physician only saw the uninsured. That's sort of how I read it.
Senator Wesley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wesley, District 27. Nothing simple, I understand that, but let me take it upon myself to get a clarification and a consistency between the definition of clinic in 443 and 605. Your issue, Senator Montes-Anderson, you're not going to get down to managing patient mix in these clinics when push comes to shove, and you don't want those strings to bind anyway. So, I mean, the easy, obvious solution is get a clarification and consistency between the two definitions of clinic and then those two technical/not-so-technical amendments cleaned up in the dash twos for 443 and put it on your desk with a great big bow prior to Thursday.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Yes. I guess I'd suggest, Senator Westland, that the way this is currently drafted, where it just says low income, it's a general statement, but when you put uninsured in there, it's a limiting factor, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily where you want to go. I'm comfortable with the language where it is, I think. But
however, if they have insurance, mm-hmm. someone's going to get paid.
Right, but if you put uninsured in there, then... Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz and Senator Montes-Anderson, I think the key concept behind 605, and this is where we have to square the definitions, is that the health care providers who are protected currently under what I call the Good Samaritan Law, and the clinics who would share in that immunity, only happens when those healthcare providers are serving without remuneration.
Right.
And I think we all agree that that's the targeted professional we want to encourage to participate. What we have to find is the right term of art that's not delimiting on the clinics that they'd be working in.
Right. And they have access to other providers, whether it's commercial side or OHP.
Very good. Very good. Before you leave, the fiscal impact. You say there is no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, with the deletion of lines 8 through 10,
okay.
The practice or the activities of informing professionals through trade and professional organizations will be done within existing resources.
That's a good thing.
Okay. We will hear this bill then Friday, and hopefully we will be rid of the fiscal. Hopefully we will. Okay, we're going to close Senate Bill 605, and we're going to stand at ease for just a moment because we have Representative Butler is going to be here shortly. That's fine. That's fine. open a public hearing on Senate Bill 778, and Representative Butler, would you come up, please? Well, go ahead. Are you ready, Representative?
You bet.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you.
Always ready.
Always ready.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 778. I'm State Representative Tom Butler from southeastern Oregon, representing House District 60. I appreciate the chair's sensitivity in sponsoring Senate Bill 778 on behalf of the small rural health clinic revolving account for Area Education Center's program, the Rural Health and Safety Net programs. In southeastern Oregon, House District 60, we have three of the list of about 20 statewide of these small rural health clinic centers. And these serve not just our Oregon population, but down in Jordan Valley, the small health clinic in Jordan Valley services Highway 95, which serves, of course, both into Idaho as well as Nevada. Very, very busy portion of the state when it comes to transportation in the north and south sector. This is the lifeblood of these communities. Many times we feel that the education centers and our schools are the lifeblood of these small communities. But in fact, a great deal of the livelihood of the community is dependent upon the clinics on behalf of which I am testifying today. I also represent Baker County, which has one of these clinics in remote Halfway, Oregon, and that little clinic out in Halfway has had enormous community support, and the people of the community supported a great deal. And so it's very important. Typically these are very poor segments of the population, folks that do not have the kinds of insurance and financial resources that we would be accustomed to in the larger metropolitan areas, and consequently their base from which they draw in the rural population, the aging and our rural economies are very, very difficult to service relative to the financial commitments. I would just say this with regard to some of these small rural clinics. They have, and I speak on behalf of having just toured the one in Jordan Valley this past summer. It also has a dental chair and an opportunity for folks to see a dentist about once every 2 weeks. A dentist will come from the state of Idaho. Remember that Jordan Valley can't be accessed very easily from any highway in Oregon. It has to be, you have to travel from either from the state of Idaho on Highway 95 or the state of Nevada on 95 to get to Jordan Valley as it weaves itself along the state borders there. So I encourage your thorough examination and support of Senate Bill 778, and again acknowledge and with gratitude the chair, Senator Morissette, having brought forward this bill to assist us in these funding activities of these rural health care.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Irv, would you come up? Representative. Representative Witt. Mr. Fletcher.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Irv Fletcher, legislative aide to the Representative Brad Witt of District 31, who would like to be here today, but he's back attending the funeral of his dad in Massachusetts. So he asked me to submit that on his behalf. Self-explanatory, and that's the extent of my testimony.
You want to get into the details of the bill?
No, I have my... My friend Ed Patterson back there will do that for me. Just to say, the older you get, the more you experience these clinics and hospitals.
Thank you very much, Irving.
Thank you.
Hey, Ed Patterson and Karen. Oh, okay. Representative Gilman, I'm sorry. Would you come up, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm representing George Gilman from District 55, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 778.
778. In the Senate, we just do one.
And the reason I am here is because we have a clinic in Christmas Valley. It's very important to the citizens there, and we would like to continue it. That's all I have.
You don't want to get into the details of earlier.
I do not. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate your being here.
I point out that the support in the House seems to be bipartisan. So
yes,
that's a good thing.
Thank you. Okay, so now to get into the details of the bill, Ed Patterson and Karen Whitaker, would you come up, please? Ed, would you like to introduce yourself and start off?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ed Patterson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Rural Health Association. And I was requested to explain what the amendments were that we're going to be discussing before I launched my testimony. Essentially, we have three sets of amendments, and through the good sense of Senator Morissette, he said, make it right. So it took me three times to get it right. So dash one, dash two are meaningless. We think the dash threes are important ones and really fixes the bill so it's easy to understand. Basically, what the amendments do is it amends the statute covering the tobacco tax. And you'll see in the bill itself, Section 1 is the ORS that covers how the tobacco tax is dealt with and distributed throughout the state. And the amendments themselves delete lines 10 through 13, which talks about funds going to the Office of Rural Health to provide rural financial assistance to develop health safety net clinics. And puts in new language, puts in three new sections. One is to provide funding for emergency medical services enhancement. The second is to add funds, tobacco tax funds, for the rural health facilities. And three, to provide funds for the rural health viability grants, all three of which will be funded through the Office of Rural Health. Section 2 of the bill amends the Oregon laws. Holly Robinson drafted the bill and explained the difference to me between Oregon laws and ORS, but I still don't understand it. For some reason, there are Oregon laws that are not ORS, are not statutory, but both have to be amended. So Section 2 amendments do exactly the same thing as Section 3. Amendments to Section 2 do exactly the same thing as the amendments to Section 1. And deletes the same previous language contained in the bill. And on the Section 4 of the bill, on page 3, section line 3, there's an ORS citation that had to be changed because it wasn't, the new language will now identify, the new citation will identify what the language reflects and does away with Section 4. So virtually what you have now is a bill that has the A and B sections of distribution of tobacco tax and adds new C, D, and E sections. And that's all the bill does in terms of the amendment. So when we testify, at least I know between Karen and I, when we testify, we're testifying on behalf of the bill with the Dash 3 amendment. Now, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll continue on with our testimony if that's an adequate explanation.
So we've got administrative rules, we've got ORS, and then we've got law. I didn't know that. Senator Starr, did you know that? They ought to educate us better.
Well, you'd think after being around here for 20 years myself, or 30, I would know the difference. But I'm doing some research on this bill, Senator Cruz. You recall the bill that you folks passed back in the 2001 session, which is 2015, and it was a consensus of what you learned in your trip throughout Eastern Oregon. That is not statutory either. That's part of the Oregon laws, not in statutes. And as I understand it, it's an arbitrary decision that's made in legislative council. But Holly Robinson could explain, maybe so you could understand, because I didn't.
Here Holly is listening, hoping that we don't call her down. We've done that before. We will forego that right now. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Karen and I have been working on this bill since you made the request to put something together, and we're here testifying together, and my job, first thing, is to lead off with kind of an overview about what the bill does and why there is a need for it. And Karen will follow up and talk about the details, because it directs her Office of Rural Health to do quite a few things she'll have to do. So this is not the first time we've been here, but we're here to do that. I think I'd like to lead off, Mr. Chair, by thanking you. I know your support for getting a good rural health bill has been valuable for us, and in the past, and it's going to be valuable again. Mm-hmm. This measure is kind of the omnibus rural health bill, and there's several things that I think you can be pleased with, and I think the people in rural Oregon, when they learn of the bill's passage, and we hope it does, will be very pleased with the work that you've done on this. Having said that, the bill itself has a preamble. I think the bill's it declares it to be the policy of the state to have a sustainable rural health safety net. And the safety net will consist of pre-hospital emergency care, access to primary care providers, and modernized rural hospitals. This policy statement is extremely important. In the past years, all three of these programs have been established and have been funded by the legislature, but the funds have been taken away, and the programs have been put on hold until there is more money. So this policy statement clearly states that rural health has unique challenges and must not be swept under the rug for future policymakers. And we have done this on rare occasions. Legislative council is not fond of these policy statements, but I think they're important for future policy decisions. So we put that in the preamble to the bill. The bill funds the rural health programs through the use of existing tobacco tax revenue and does not require any new taxes. Tobacco taxes continue to play a major role in providing health care services to all Oregonians. We believe that sustaining a rural health safety net with tobacco taxes is a very legitimate use of this resource. The Department of Revenue states, and this is talking about a separate source of tobacco funds, but I think the committee needs to be aware of. The Department of Revenue reports that through June 2003, Oregon received $339.4 million in payments by tobacco manufacturers through the Master Settlement Agreement. That's the lawsuit settlement. And is expected to receive $144.6 million for the 2003-05 biennium. The 2003 session, Senate Bill 856, arranged to pledge much of this revenue of $450 million in bond proceeds to grants for schools. You may recall that exercise last session. Funds that were allegedly to be compensation to states for the cost of providing health care to persons suffering from the use of tobacco products. So you can see there is a lot of money that originally was intended to go to health care that did not go to health care. As you can see from the following table, in the last full fiscal year, 2003-04, the state received $265.4 million of tobacco revenue, tax revenue. Of those funds, $189.3 million went to help fund the Oregon Health Plan. The balance of the funds went to the general fund, cities and counties, the Oregon Department of Transportation, and the Tobacco Use Reduction Account. In fiscal year 2003-04, and this is the basis for making the allocations for this bill, you can see where in the chart it shows that 89.65% went to the general fund, 3.4% went to cities and counties. 1.7% went to ODOT. The general fund portion allocated in the original section. 51.92% went to the Oregon Health Plan. That's $189.3 million. 5.77% or $7.6 million went to the tobacco use reduction account, and $53.9 million went to the general fund. This bill suggests that 0.7% should go to the rural EMS enhancement account. That's $0.85 million. 0.85% should go to isolated rural health facilities. That's $1 million. And 2% should go to the rural health viability grant fund. That's $2.5 million. This totals $4.35 million that would go to the Sustainable Rural Health Program, and that would be 1.6% of the total amount of funds on an annual basis. And these are annual amounts, not biennial amounts. A safety net will improve the delivery of rural emergency medical services, a safety net that will increase access to rural primary care providers, and a safety net that will assist critical access hospitals in finding ways to modernize aging facilities is the entire purpose of this bill. We urge the committee to adopt the dash three amendments and send the bill to the Ways and Means Committee for further consideration and funding. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Center for Rural Health at OHSU, which includes the State Office of Rural Health. And I am here to talk about Senate Bill 778 as amended with the dash three amendments. It addresses the critical issues that make up the rural health safety net, and the bill assigns three principal duties to the Office of Rural Health. Our first duty under the bill would be to focus on pre-hospital care, and funding would be restored for a program that proved to be very successful from 1999 through 2003, the Emergency Medical Services Enhancement Account. I have attached a map to your handout. It's this one with the state in yellow. It has little ambulances all over the state. And this shows you what we managed to accomplish in 4 years with the funds through the Emergency Medical Services Enhancement Account. We bought 12 ambulances, rescue vehicles. We bought 79 defibrillators, 3 ventilators, 107 radios, 103 pagers, 10 jaws of life rescue extrication tools. We did repairs. We bought insurance for numerous rescue vehicles and other miscellaneous patient care items. We believe that the funds that we were able to give to rural communities through this account really saved lives in rural Oregon, not only for the people who live and work there, but also for the people who travel Oregon's rural roads for recreational and travel purposes. Just last week, a report was published about rural roads. I heard about it on OPB. Some of you may have heard about it. I was driving back from Salem, as a matter of fact, and heard about this report. I went to work the next day and went looking for it, and as it turned out, it was already posted on our website in our office, so our webmaster was very alert. This report points out that traffic facilities are occurring on the nation's non-interstate rural roads at a rate of approximately 2.5 times higher than all other roads. And in Oregon, they look at this state by state, there were 2.74 fatalities per 100 million miles of travel on rural roads compared to 0.72 fatalities on all other routes. That's a difference of more than 380%.
May I interrupt for just a moment? We've been dealing with ODOT concerning freight highways, and mm-hmm. and there's a local issue in Lane County with the McKinsey Highway, which is being removed from that designation. However, in talking with the trucking industry, you know, we're hearing that the amount of freight on all Oregon highways will increase significantly in the next few years, and that is all Oregon highways are actually freight highways. So I understand what you're saying, and they're you know, these are unpatrolled, basically. They're mm-hmm. hard to get to. There's taking on, putting on chains, taking off chains, putting them on. There's all kinds of hazards out there, and I know that the EMT and the ambulance services and everybody else, they're stretched to the max, you know, and so that's part of the reason we're doing this, I think, is that because there is a crisis situation in many rural parts of the state, and it's getting worse.
Yes, Senator Morissette, you're absolutely right. This report points out that rural roads are less likely, are likely to have poor design, sharp curves, some limited visibility, but I think it's important to remember that the people who published this report are people who are trying to get more roads built. So they didn't mention the emergency medical services component of this equation, and we do know that some of the reason for higher traffic deaths on rural highways has to do with the lack of emergency medical services, or at least the response time that it takes for emergency personnel to reach a vehicle accident. And I have a graph also on page 2 that looks at deaths due to unintentional injuries in Oregon per 100,000 population by type of county. And our frontier counties are the far eastern counties, including Grant and Baker and Harney and Malheur counties out in the far eastern part of the state, where there are fewer than 6 people per square mile. Rural counties are those where all the population is rural, and mixed, there is a mixture of rural and urban population, like Lane County, for example, and then, of course, there's the urban county. In urban counties, which is Multnomah County, period, it's the only county that doesn't have any rural population in the state. The last time we looked at the data, and I have to tell you, I haven't been able to find anything more recent than 1999, and that's what we used the last time we talked about this in front of the legislature. It hasn't been studied since then. The response time in Multnomah County to a 911 call was 8 minutes. And the response time, average response time to a 911 call in frontier counties was 4.5 hours, which is just staggering. But the reason for that is that nearly all of the EMS personnel in those very rural counties are volunteers. So the first thing that has to be done is they have to be contacted. And they may be teaching school, they may be farming, they may be, they're engaged in their regular occupations, and then they have to muster together wherever the vehicle is that they need to use. And then they have to go find this person who may be an hour or two away if they're on a very remote road. So your chances of surviving a very serious traffic accident in frontier counties are really not as good as they are, obviously, in urban counties. And we really believe that providing some of this emergency medical equipment and training did increase the survivability of traffic accidents in very rural parts of the state. We were very disappointed when we lost that funding. The second part of the bill deals with primary care and addresses Oregon's certified rural health clinics, the types of clinics that Representative Butler was talking about. Our office's field staff conducted an on-site survey of all Oregon's rural health clinics just in the last 6 months and published a very nice report that contained their findings. We'd be happy to provide you with a copy of this to those of you who are interested in the report. They concluded that the average rural health clinic, and there are 52 of them in Oregon, has 3,381 visits per year. They make almost $300,000 in patient revenue. But their average operating expense is $328,000, and their average operating margin is a negative 13.8%. 70% report a negative operating margin, and 35% report an overall negative margin. And while all the 52 rural health clinics face similar challenges, we have targeted those that are least likely to succeed without intervention. And we're calling those isolated rural health facilities, and they are a subset of current rural health clinics. In most cases, these isolated clinics simply do not have enough people in their service areas to support a clinic. And Jordan Valley, the clinic that Representative Butler brought up as an example, is a good example of that as well. Yet if one of them closes, people who live there in Jordan Valley would have to drive 110 miles to the nearest source of primary care. So it really is essential that we keep these clinics open. But they do not have enough patients in their service area because the population is so sparse. If everybody in the area came to their clinic, they still would not be able to raise enough revenue to meet their overhead and operating expenses. So we believe that those very small rural clinics deserve some operating support, and that the best way to assure survival to these clinics involves a combination of cash flow and technical support. I've also attached a map that shows you where those clinics are in the state. As you can see, there really aren't very many of them, but all of them are the sole source of care in their communities. The bill would provide for a supplement to their operating expenses based on need and support for technical assistance that would include annual board governance training, development of an annual strategic plan, help with their reporting mechanisms, assistance toward full participation in Medicaid and Medicare, development and operation of a schedule of discounts or a sliding fee scale, and the maintenance of their existing rural health clinic status or federally qualified health center look-alike status, if that's applicable. After many years of working with and observing the operations of fragile, isolated clinics, our field staff has determined that this approach is the only one that will ensure continuous availability of quality health care to rural Oregonians who live in isolated communities. The third part of the bill that applies to the Office of Rural Health is the first step towards solving the problem of access to needed capital for rural facilities by providing seed money for the Rural Health Viability Grants, which were authorized by the 2001 legislature. And through what I can only call a series of unfortunate events, never received their funding. Another report, this has been the week for reports. Another report just released last week by the Health Resources and Services Administration looks at critical access hospitals nationwide. 22 of Oregon's 35 rural hospitals are categorized as critical access hospitals. That is a federal program that was designed to improve reimbursement for small rural hospitals and allow them to continue operation. It gives them cost-based Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement, but it's important to point out that it only meets their cost. It doesn't provide for any margin, and so it doesn't provide for any help in capital expenses. The report concludes that their program is successful and that more hospitals are able to meet their operating costs, but that hospitals are not obtaining the capital they need. The report goes on to say that capital is critical for them to be able to renovate or construct facilities to expand operations and services to remain viable and effective. Those hospitals unable to keep pace with depreciation, advances in medical technology, and changing population need are at risk for not only compromising their performance, but increasing their risk of closure and jeopardizing the availability of needed services for rural populations. Mr. Don Nyberg, who is here at the table with us, who is a hospital architect, performed a thorough examination of Oregon's critical access hospitals last year and will share his findings with you regarding the unmet capital needs of Oregon's rural hospitals. Hospitals, of course, are not the only rural facilities in need of assistance. In compliance with the original bill that established the Rural Health Viability Grants, the grants would be available for other purposes as well, including modernization of capital equipment, preservation of access to local health services in rural areas through support of vulnerable rural health providers, expanded community health educational opportunities, incentives for the development of long-term sustainable approaches to improving health care services in increased access to quality health care in rural areas, collaborative approaches that sustain access to quality rural health care, and expanded or sustained health care for financially and physically vulnerable rural populations. And Senator Morissette asked me prior to the hearing if these funds could not be used for transportation issues for seniors so they can access health care in rural communities, and I think that certainly fits well within the criteria that have already been established. Senate Bill 778 represents a fairly modest investment that would return impressive dividends for rural Oregonians, and I'm very grateful to Senator Morissette for introducing it. I think I would also like to add that there has been a fair amount of concern about this bill regarding the funding source. And I want to point out that the way the funds are distributed, none of the sources that currently existing entities that receive funds from the cigarette tax would be affected. The funds that we're talking about, the percentages, would be drawn down from the remainder, the balance that goes into the general fund. So none of the existing recipients of cigarette taxes would be affected by Senate Bill 778. I think it's important to point that out. If you have any questions about my testimony, I'd be happy to answer them, and thank you for the time to testify and support.
I just want to say that I called you earlier in the year before the session started concerning the conference that I came from, that I went to a rural health segment, and this was in Savannah, Georgia, and the main person who testified was a senator from the state of West Virginia, and it focused on a major grant, foundation grant, that established rural health facilities are much like what we're trying to do here. And so I expressed a real interest in this, and you were familiar with that granting cycle that was focused on the Southwest, and it was a multi-state grant that, and I talked to people from the various states, and I was absolutely impressed with what they were able to build upon. It was a relatively small grant, but it did expand to foundation support, well, state support, foundation support, bank support, lending for at low interest for facilities, and in conjunction with Senator Cruz and the work that we have done in the past to establish a fund that we could use to build upon, this was the reason why I was really interested in this. Now, I did also raise an issue during a session that we had at Willamette University when the Senate met to kind of get to know each other and go through some exercises, and one of them was with the Ford Family Foundation, and there were two individuals there, and we were asked to project our image of what will it be like in the year 2012 based upon what you do this year. And so what I said, looking at the gentleman from the Ford Family Foundation, is that, well, in the year 2005, the Ford Family Foundation came forth with a relatively large grant that we were able to invest in rural health care. And that allowed us to build a fairly substantial program to fund, build communities. It was a community building grant that focused on health care. I later talked to another gentleman from the Ford Family Foundation who specializes in small community grants, up to $15,000 to $30,000 for community building. I would like to use this as a seed for growing a larger effort to really do some work in rural Oregon, and to take advantage of whatever help we can get from not only the Ford Family Foundation, but other funding sources. And I think they're looking for a good faith effort by the state. If we put something in, they are likely to put something in. They're not going to just give us the money unless we do something. So I think what we need to do with this bill is to get is to move it with a broad base of support that I hope we have in this building, and then go out and see if we can expand it to something that in the year 2012 will really make a difference. So with that, Dr. Nyberg, I'd like to hear... Oh, I'm sorry.
I just want to follow up. I also thank you for this bill, Senator. This is an attempt to partially restore a promise that was made in 2001, and I was looking back in this joint interim field trip that we had in 2000. Interesting enough, of the 10 people in the legislature that went on that field trip, Senator, you and I are the only ones that are still in the legislature, which does speak to the fact that term limit seems to work without legislation. But there was a promise made through a different funding source, and that promise went away. New administration, new day, and I think this is a good start towards fulfilling a promise we were part of making to rural Oregon, and we're still here to make it happen. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Knapp.
Just for the record, I'm Donald Nyberg, an architect and health facilities consultant and former manager of the health the facilities review section of the Health Services Division. I was asked some time ago to do an on-site review of small rural hospitals in Oregon and assess their physical condition and modernization needs. Most of these hospitals were built with the assistance of Hill-Burton funds, starting with Tillamook General Hospital back in 1949, and the program died in 1979. I toured 12 hospitals, all the way from Enterprise to Gold Beach on the southern Oregon coast. Each hospital was reviewed first, comparing the construction type to the type currently required by our state building codes. And then I looked at deficiencies that had been cited by either the Office of State Fire Marshal or the Joint Commission on Accreditation, who go in and do routine inspections of these facilities. I'm not really doing a thorough review of my own. The amount of noncompliance in those areas, at least in meeting minimum requirements, was not that great, probably because of the routine inspection and required modifications. I did no detailed review of seismic conformance, but did note the age of all the various building wings and noted the seismic zone or risk zone in which that hospital was located. And interestingly, some of the older hospitals are located in areas of highest risk. I then did a review, a department-by-department review of departments in each facility, comparing the features of that department with what would be required if it were being built to today's standards, licensure rules of the Health Services Division or other applicable standards. And with no requirement that they come up to all those standards, but giving a percentage rating of compliance so that as that percentage of compliance went down, it gave us a nice tool for looking at not only modernization need, but comparing the need of for modernization between facilities. I did a cursory review of mechanical and electrical systems, including their heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems, which in hospitals are important for infection control. I looked at medical, gas, and vacuum systems, water and other plumbing systems, and did a cursory review of the electrical systems, including emergency power, nurse call, special grounding, and critical care areas, and so on. And then lastly, I did a cursory review for ADA compliance, and it turned out that was one of the largest areas of noncompliance, with only one of the 12 hospitals really being pretty much complying. Review, there's about a 30 or 40 page report on each hospital, but the reviews were summarized in a little booklet, which some of you may have seen before. Karen tells me that she will provide a copy to any of you that request one. But it gives us a summary of the ratings by hospital and then by inpatient bed areas and the support areas on the nursing floors, like nurses' stations and utility rooms and all the other features required. And then for ancillary service areas and support service areas of the hospital, emergency, laboratory, imaging, and clear on down to laundry and dietary facilities. And the last page of the report really gives us kind of a summary of what happens, and what you find is that there's a lot of difference in modernization need between facilities, with some of them having, you know, fairly severe needs. One hospital only getting a 42% compliance rating for its nursing areas and support features 55 or departments 55%, and then others scoring, you know, closer to 100. So severe need amongst certain hospitals. A few additional observations. You know, it was obvious that those older hospitals were built for a model of care we no longer see. Heavy on inpatient care, long lengths of stay, resulting in most cases overbeddedness, and in a lot of cases, if not all, those bed areas have been converted or are used on a make-do basis to serve other needs. Some had failing or non-compliant medical gas vacuum systems, and that's real important because, you know, if you have a complete failure or a failure of oxygen supply in an area and you have a patient with an oxygen mask or an infant tended for oxygen, and there's a failure, you need alarms and systems to alert staff that they have a problem right now. Emergency power systems were kind of interesting because the typical solution for most of the hospitals was to put in a big enough generator that it would serve the entire facility. Well, that doesn't really do the job because modern standards require that that emergency system be divided into three branches with a critical and life safety and equipment branches. So, because you don't want the critical branches, the critical circuits interrupted because of some problem with some unrelated piece of equipment. Unfortunately, at the time many of these old facilities were built, those circuits are mixed, and it's very difficult to go back and correct them at this time, not without a lot of cost anyway. Air filtration and ventilation were a significant problem, and as I said, very important for infection control because you bring in, you know, clean, highly filtered air in the most critical areas such as surgery and intensive care. That air goes on out to less sterile areas of the hospital and the corridors, and then it's finally picked up at janitors' closets and dirty utility rooms and decontam rooms and those places that you, from which you don't want to recirculate air, and it's exhausted on out at that point. If you don't have proper ventilation and that air moving in the right direction, it's an increase in infection risk for cross-contamination. Some of the facilities were poorly arranged for staffing efficiency, and the thing I really noticed the most is that some of them had been built with OB facilities totally isolated and separate from medical and surgical beds. And while it's important to keep mothers and new infants separated from sick people in the hospital, there are ways to handle that and still minimize the need for duplicate staff. Isolation facilities were often not up to par in terms of meeting requirements of the Health Services Division or the Centers for Disease Control. Many of the hospitals have a problem in not having facilities to take care of people who come in who are mentally ill or otherwise disruptive or have a contamination problem of some sort. Despite all these problems, you know, I really have to congratulate the staff in most of those hospitals because they sure try hard, and I think, you know, really do a wonderful job given the limitations. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, I guess we saw some of those hospitals when we did our trip a couple of years ago. The configuration is wrong. They're trying to move things around that aren't appropriate, and so I don't know if we're going to have another round of federal funding. I doubt it. I think, though, that we have... Oh, okay. I guess what I see in our grand scheme is that as we go into communities and try to build the healthcare facilities that focus around the hospital, and I know that many of them have districts, and that's up to the the districts to step up to the plate and do their part in terms of the funding of a facility. But I think we have to be aware of those things that you've pointed out in each and every community. So, thank you very much. Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Ken Armstrong, Ellen Lowe, would you both please come up? Ellen, are you here? And then we will have Dr. Charles Caspian, Angie Dukes, and then Ruby. So we've got about 20 minutes.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Member of the committee, Ken Armstrong. I'm here representing the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. I don't have any new information. I want to communicate that the association has taken a look at this and is extremely supportive of Senate Bill 778. The information that particularly was outlined in Ms. Whitaker's report, I think, does a good job of communicating the importance of the way this bill can help the rural areas of the state. The Volunteer Firefighters Association, about 8,000 of Oregon's 10,000 firefighters are volunteers. Most of those are here in these areas where you see the ambulances. So I think that can give you a sense for the importance to the members that I represent of the things that this bill will do. Some of the numbers seem small, 12 ambulances, 3 ventilators, 107 radios, but when you're talking about districts and communities that have very, very little in the way of resources, these can make tremendous differences from the standpoint of saving lives, and as I think you know, but to make sure that it's clear for the record, what is happening in the fire service these days is that most of the activity is in the EMS side, much more than fighting fires. And so this kind of thing is the sort of thing that helps us do our job, protect the lives of Oregonians and those that are passing through the state. With that, I just want to communicate our support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I'm Ellen Lowe. I serve as a legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank and the Oregon Law Center. And both of these groups function statewide in service to low-income Oregonians. And so we have really come to understand the unique needs that are really there in rural areas as they seek to provide timely, medically appropriate access for Oregon's needy. And we believe that the services that are cited in 778 are integral to a healthy statewide health care system. And since the funding for Senate Bill 778 comes from the general fund portion of the tobacco tax, we really do encourage you to forward it to Ways and Means with a favorable recommendation so that it can become part of the discussion
in that human service subcommittee as they look at the health care system. I'm sorry that Senator Mona Sanderson has left, because I've noted in that subcommittee sometimes her frustration with the process they've had in phase one and then in their priority setting, where they've been limited to what was in the governor's budget. And that discussion in phase two really needs to be expanded to look at a health care system that serves all Oregonians. And we believe that it's appropriate that you offer this to that discussion, because we welcome all opportunities now for us to look at our health care needs in terms of our statewide system, because we haven't been. And if we only confine our discussion to what is in the governor's budget, it won't be with what many of us have assumed was a commitment that was made by your previous bodies many years ago to Oregonians. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure Senator Mona Sanderson will be back soon, but I would ask you to convey your feelings to her personally, that and she is in a very important position to help move this along. And Ken, I would like to have your card before you leave, or your
absolutely,
so I can get in touch with you, because we're going to need all the help we can get.
Yes, sir.
Moving this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. and Angie and Ruby. Okay.
Chair Morissette, member of the committee. Maybe we'll have members again. Members of the committee. My name is Angie Dilks, and I am here today representing the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon. Mm-hmm. And that group represents the 12 Medicaid managed care plans in Oregon. We're here in support of what you've heard from the Office of Rural Health, but in opposition to this bill because of the funding source.
Okay.
Dr. Crispin is here today to talk a little bit about his perspective as a rural health provider,
mm-hmm.
But we are opposed to this bill.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Charles Crispin. I'm a pediatrician in Grants Pass. I've been in Oregon since 1985 and been involved with rural health since 1980. Originally was in a hospital with virtually no lab, no x-ray, in rural Iowa, and came here initially through the Rural Health Service Corps in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent the last 20 years in the Pacific Northwest, 4 years on a little hiatus up to Seattle. I don't know what possessed me to leave this state, but currently we have a pediatric clinic in Grants Pass. It participates in two of the three managed care Oregon Health Plan programs and is also a designated rural health clinic. So I feel a perspective for both sides. And I mostly, I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk to you. I'm in favor of anything that you can do to help the rural health situation. I have kudos for what Karen Whitaker has said. I agree with everything that she said virtually, and I'm glad that somebody's saying those things up here. I have other people that I know in the Rural Health Program, and I also think they do a good job. My perspective, I guess, on this is that both the Oregon Health Plan and the Rural Health Program serve important roles in rural health. We, as an independent physicians association in Grants Pass, attempt to do some recruiting, but also I think rural health probably has a much broader ability to do that. On the other hand, the rural health group tends to recruit primary care physicians. And right now, in Southern Oregon, one of the biggest problems is recruiting specialty people. There's days of the week in Southern Oregon where there's not an orthopedist or a neurosurgeon available in Medford or any place. And this is because of difficulties with reimbursement. And so I basically have two concerns about 778, not necessarily negative or positive, just questions. One of them is that if there is some essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul, taking from some potential source for Oregon Health Plan in order to fund this, which I think it's a great thing to fund, I have trouble with that. I would like to see you find some source of funding outside of either program, so if there is any loss of robbing Peter to pay Paul, that wouldn't happen. The other issue that I have a little bit of concern, again, I'm not a specialist. I don't know about, special needs things, but I do have a concern about what type of access hospitals might have to any part of the third part of the proposal in this bill, in terms of the fact that, for instance, Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene owns Florence Hospital. Mm-hmm. Rogue Valley Medical Center owns Grants Pass Hospital. There are, I know, tentacles out there, and I would hate to see some of the bigger hospitals who might have their fingers in some of these peripheral hospitals be able to get this money when places that were just talked about obviously need that money. So I would hope that there are some safeguards in place to protect that money and make sure it goes where it goes. But in general, my main concern is that while I'm strongly in favor of this health net, it's wonderful to hear the people up here talking about these things. I just hope that there's not a loss in one program that's critical for rural health to supplement another area that's critical in rural health. That's what I guess I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I appreciate your concern, and this bill is going to go to Ways and Means, and the Ways and Means Committee, of which Senator Mona Sanderson is a part of, will have to make some decisions about where best to put the money. I mean, that's the reality of it, and all we can all do is make our best case, and I too hope that another program will not be damaged, but I guess that's all I can say.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just point out that 42.31% of the tobacco money in the general fund is not allocated to any specific program. So to say that we're robbing Peter to pay Paul relative to the Oregon Health Plan is probably not accurate. That's fungible across a whole bunch of different things, and I guess from the perspective of the fact that money was supposed to go to health care initially, and we fought to get it into health care, and now it's funding many other things to take 1.6% of that fund and direct it also to health care along with the health plan and the other things that are already in the budget, I think would be appropriate. And as far as the viability grants, the pretty judicious assessment done by Karen on those things, I would just be incredibly amazed if Peace Health got that money for their new building. It's just not going to happen. So I mean, you know, there's a faith issue here, and knowing the way that office operates, I'm fairly comfortable that those grants will go to the appropriate places.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking of fungible money, what we had in mind last time is to put some of the MUPL money into rural health where it should have went in the first place, and that all but disappeared.
Only $15 million.
You're ready. One of my favorite people, Ruby. I'm making you feel guilty, Ruby.
You sure are. Senator Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Ruby Houghton, and I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for CARE Oregon, Oregon's largest Oregon health plan provider in the state of Oregon, with over 100,000 OHP clients in both rural and urban Oregon. I shared with my good friend and Senator Morissette, your chair today, that this would be the first time that I've ever risen in opposition to any safety net-related health bill in my career in this building, I think. And I'm troubled by this, mainly because I love what we've talked about today, but I also recognize that in our state, in this particular time, with revenues being what they are, and the commitment that each one of you has made, as well as those of us who are sitting out here in the audience has made, we have to capitalize on every dollar that we possibly can to provide access to low-income Oregonians to receive health care now. And making sure that those dollars leverage our federal funds, making sure that those dollars bring in the money to provide the access is absolutely critical. When we talk about the tobacco tax monies, we remember that voters actually supported that so that we could provide access to health care for low-income people. The reason why we have the Oregon Health Plan in place is so that we can provide access, draw down federal dollars, and increase our pool of dollars 2-to-1, so that for every state general fund dollar that's put in, we can draw down additional federal funds until the federal government says that we can no longer do that. And thanks to Congressman Smith, we have a short reprieve in that, and we need to continue to draw down those federal dollars so that we can support low-income people who need health care in both the rural and the urban areas. So I want to bring to your attention Oregon Health Plan matching funds relative to any dollars that we have available for low-income health. And then, just like my friends who testified before me, I want to encourage you to take a look at the safety net as a whole. I've lobbied before this body for the last several sessions regarding the entire safety net health clinic and provider system that we have in place, broken as it may seem. I've lobbied as it relates to rural health, federally qualified health centers, Indian health centers, school-based health centers, and community clinics. And it was this body that broke a promise, Senator Cruz, and you're right. And we understood it. I nearly came to tears when the $3 million that this body allocated in 03 to the safety nets was taken back over those special sessions. We understood it. It hurt. And I do think that we need to be thinking about what kind of line item budget can we afford for the safety net today? And can we begin to put aside that amount of money so that we can, Chair Morissette, go to the Ford Foundation and say, we have X amount of dollars, can you match it? So that we can go to other foundations and community-based organizations and say, we are doing this good thing, can you match it? Our entire safety net deserves and desperately needs this funding, the entire safety net. But I don't want you to forget about the individuals, whether they be in rural or urban Oregon, who today need health care and access to health care. With that, I'll end my testimony. I know the day has been long, and I appreciate you taking the time to listen to me. And I apologize for being the bearer of bad news. of any kind. And it hurts me to my heart
to do this. Your being here is good, and regardless of the position you take. What I would mention, though, in talking with the Ford Family Foundation, was the fact that they also go into urban areas with their grants.
Yes,
now, that is
a
new program that they have.
Yeah.
So, you know, we may ask them to take a look at some of the urban areas where there are health clinics and so on, and go in and help. But anyway.
And Chair Moore said, I'm certain that the Safety Net Coalition, that includes all of the Safety Net partners, would be very interested in participating in that with you.
One other thing that we're working on with the Safety Net clinics is the wraparound repayment funding issue. And we had a work session the other night with Barney Spate, and we are trying to speed up the repayments, particularly the startup clinics, and to help all of them along that way. So that
wonderful.
It isn't that if we're not working for the safety.
Very much appreciated.
Okay. Thank you, Ruby.
Thank you.
Okay. We've got 2 minutes to move this bill. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 778.
Want to open a work session?
Mr. Chair?
I move the -3 amendment to Senate Bill 778.
Senator Cruz moves the -3 amendments to 778. Discussion?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to qualify my yes vote because this will be coming to Ways and Means, and we have gone through a thorough prioritization, and therefore I don't want this yes vote to mean that that's where the money's going to end up. I hope we have enough to fund everything, but we aren't. But I just wanted to qualify that my yes vote.
You were out of the room when Ellen Lowe spoke to you about...
Sorry, Ellen.
And I said, well, please talk with her privately about this issue, so she will. Thank you for the clarification. Other comments? Seeing no other comments and no disagreement, we will move the -3 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 778 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved. Senator Cruz moved 778 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Would you please call the roll?
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Monica
Sanders.
Aye.
Senator
Charles Starr.
Aye.
Chair
Morissette. Aye. Thank you. Other business from the committee? We'll close the work session. We haven't closed the
Haven't
received the necessary votes. We will move this committee to Ways and Means. Thank you. Close the public work session and close the committee.